Now, the Soul Savage Show on Studio W. man, this thing rocks. Studio W the Buzz, and now it's time for the Soul Savage Show with your hosts, Q Lynn Green and Whitney. Hey, what's going on?
Hey, Will, everything is going on.
Man, oh man.
Everything is going on, Will.
That's exactly right. Man, I am glad to be back. It was a disaster last week, Q. Disaster.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we don't need to, it's a whole story. We don't need to get into
a whole story. That's right. It wasn't a half a story. Back. It was a whole story.
Right. Right. Welcome back to Soul Savage Radio. We're giving birthday appreciations, belated birthday appreciations to, as you can hear, you know, the fabulous, the late great Rick James. It was his birthday, this week. Rest on the Hill. You know, that was, Dance With Me from his 1982 Throwing Down album. One of my favorites. And then also we're giving birthday, belated birthday appreciations to Anita Baker and Charlie Wilson throughout the show. And also, it's the 35th album anniversary of Janet Jackson's Control album today. So I had to throw that in there as well, you know, great, fantastic album. So that's just a little bit that we got going on the show. But right now we're going to introduce our very special guest that's on the line right now. He is a music writer, columnist. He's a reporter as well. He's, you know, graduated from Roosevelt University with a bachelor's degree in journalism, and also has pieces he's written on albinism and medium publications. So, and he's also from one of my favorite cities in America, Chicago. So y'all give it up right now for our special guest host, Brandon Owsley. How you doing tonight, sir?
How are you doing, Q? Hi, Will. How are you all doing? Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, no problem, man. We glad you came on. And yeah, it's a good time. I was about to throw a Rick James joke in there, but it's not. I was about to say that song puts me in a 420 mood, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna go that route.
420.
I'll be good. We're gonna get into the interview. We're gonna ask you a few questions real quick. We're not gonna introduce you to the heathen side. Just, we gotta move you to the side of the show yet.
Ease on down the road.
We can't throw all that on you at one time. Right, we gotta ease it in. We can't just throw the heathen at you at one time. That's later in the show. But right now, I'm gonna ask you just a few questions, and then my co-host Whitney's gonna ask you some, as well. I just wanna get into, in terms of, I like to call, getting into our guest background is the genesis. It's kind of blasphemous, but I'm gonna stick with it because it makes sense to me. The genesis background of this story. So I wanna know in terms of, just you growing up in Chicago, how did you take to music? Because you have so many different titles. You're also a connoisseur of music, and you study the historical and cultural side of black music as well. And you also have a minor in black studies as well. So I wanted to get into that in terms of just your upbringing in Chicago. What was it about music for you that stood out where you're from?
Well, thank you again. My background in music really starts with my parents. I grew up in I wouldn't say a musically affluent family, but there was music everywhere. We had in the old house that I used to live here in Chicago, we had a family music collection with vinyl, and I was just intrigued, you know, just intrigued with vinyl records and looking at the credits and just, you know, from an early age. And, you know, my mother really was into gospel music, which was, really how I first got into, to appreciate black music and, you know, my understanding of just what it was that I loved. And my father, he branched out between gospel and jazz and soul, and so this really was all that I ever heard. And from there, I was just always intrigued by music. I can't make it more plainer than that. And then as I got older, thankfully I grew up in the time where CD reissues were at their peak, you know, when it came to R&B and soul. And I remember just going into a lot of CD stores and looking at just different artists, just classic albums that were reissued. And I took a chance reading liner notes and just being fascinated with a lot of the authors behind the liner notes and reading up on the artists and researching and doing all of this. And I really tapped into what I wanted to do as a career, which was to be a music journalist. So I just always took to writing and about music and researching and digging out the cultural aspects of Black music history. It's just fascinating.
Wow. And what was it in particular about? I guess I should ask, in terms of like the certain music that you gravitated towards, was there like any like artist in particular, when you first heard it, you was like, that's music, like the way you grew up, understand it and make you delve deeper into the music?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was an assortment of artists that I was introduced as a child. I can't particularly remember the first artist, but one of the artists that my father loved was Anita Baker. And I remember just, you know, he used to have a cassette tape of I believe it was Rapture or Giving You the Best That I Got, and he would just play it all the time. And then he would go from her and go on to Sounds of Blackness, and then it would be Wes Montgomery. I mean, just an eclectic range of music of that I took with me, and I just love that. I just took to it. And then from there, you know, my of course there was Stevie Wonder, Prince. I remember with Prince, I remember first being introduced with him with the Purple Rain film, and it just changed my mind. Like, everything from there, I was just like, okay, you know, I was just a fan from that point. And then Stevie, of course, the original Musicarium album, compilation album, that we used to have on cassette, and I would just play it like all of the time. So I there was just an eclectic range of music that I was just introduced to as a young child, and I gravitated toward that.
Who's your Mount Rushmore of music, like your top four, if you had to pick?
Top four, well, number one would absolutely be Stevie Wonder. There's no, I regard him as the greatest multi-instrumentalist of all time. There's just no way there's no way you can really hate or deny Stevie Wonder's power or influence. There's just no way. And then if I were to pick a second, it would be Prince. And if I were to pick a third, it would probably be, see, that would be a tricky one. Because I would say Michael Jackson or Marvin Gaye, if I could do a tie, but it'll probably be Marvin Gaye, and then for the fourth, maybe Aretha Franklin. Maybe Aretha Franklin. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
That's dope. So it's Stevie, Prince. You said it was Marvin Gaye and what was the fourth one?
For the third one, I had a little tie, because I can't, it's like, okay, Michael and Marvin, like I can't really juggle between the two, so I had to do a tie there.
Right. Either way, to me, I try to put them in different categories. It was a musician I was talking to last week, and we're talking about, like, we could do, like, subcategories of a Mount Rushmore, because we got, like, a list for, like, bass players, guitarists, and, like, the top Mount Rushmores, and then we got it for singers. Like, for me, my musicians is, like, Prince, Rick James, Roger Troutman, and Sly Stone. Like, that's just in terms of, like, the, I got, like, a little brand, and then I have one with, like, the best keyboardist, like with Stevie Wonder. It's just different categories, you know, Babyface,
yeah,
Chip, mm-hmm. Chip Crawford. I have it all, like, listed differently, but, yeah, that's a solid list, though. But, yeah, I feel like it's so many of those legends that have a musical branch that extended from, like, we're going to talk about Charlie Wilson later in the show, and you can literally follow the musical tree of Charlie just going, not just, just the 90s alone, you can follow through there, like,
absolutely.
You know, the obvious ones like Aaron Hall and, this, Rob Kelly guy, I want to say his, I want to say his, the artist's name, but whatever, you want to add that, add that in there, and, Raphael Sadiq, like they all have those different branches underneath there, so I would put that in there. But just going on with your background in journalism, how did that, so in terms of your writing, what was it, what I wouldn't say your first piece, but what was it that made you want to write about, or what age was it that made you want to start writing about music?
Well, yeah, okay, so when I was younger, again, I would buy, like, albums, and this was around the time when the marketplace would flood with CD reissues of classic albums, and usually, you know, the label would commission writers to write on that particular album that was being reissued. So, you know, around like the late 90s to 2000s, you know, we had just this influx of albums that were being remastered and reissued. And I can't remember the particular album that was reissued, but I just remember just buying just a load of albums and cracking open the book and reading the liner notes, and they were just amazing. Like writers like Mark Anthony Neal, or David Nathan, you know, on who would write a lot of on particular albums and artists, soul artists of that time. And I was just mesmerized. I was like, okay, you know, this is amazing. And then, of course, given my background in music and what my family were listening to, I just took to music and wanted to write about this and write about certain artists. I want to throw in there also, you know, as a kid, I grew up around the time of VH1 and MTV, and you know, they used to play, you know, they used to have specials, you know, week-long specials for certain artists, like, you know, Prince. They would have a weekend for Prince, or if Michael Jackson was releasing an album, a new album, they would have one on Michael, or if Madonna, or so on and so forth. And I just wanted to know more about them, and you know, you look at the different specials that, you know, VH1 or MTV would produce, and it was just phenomenal. You know, I was just blessed to be in the midst of when music was really appreciated, and, you know, mainstream really gravitated to, you know, giving the spotlight to legends and, you know, who we revere today, you know. And I just gravitated toward that, and it just made me want to, you know, step into music journalism. You know, I love research. I love interviewing. I love to, read about different genres of music, and I love telling stories. So I love information like that, and informing the public about, you know, things that they've probably never known, or, you know, new information that they would find interesting. So I really enjoyed that.
You know, you're hitting on something in terms of the, when you first started with the line, talking about the liner notes, like that was mm-hmm. a thing for me as well, just looking at it, because it wasn't until certain albums to where I was noticing, like, hey, this this person, the producer, whoever, the songwriter, I'm like, hey, they're on this other album that I was listening to. And then it was just sort of like connecting those, especially with LaFace Records, with Babyface and L.A. Reid's productions and Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis productions and songwriting. I noticed, you know, it was like, and that was there. And then LaFace, you would see, like, I was listening to. This album just by Midnight Star and all that, you know, you see their names listed on there, and it's like, oh, that's who they are. And then when you were mentioning the like those little, for me it was like the behind the music documentaries, because that was where.
Yes. Oh yeah.
Those were like a whole thing. I remember like watching those like almost every week. They would have like, if they were in a season, they would talk about it. It didn't matter who it was. It was like, it'd be like Bono, it would be Mary J. Blige, it'd be just an array of artists, and I would just sit there and listen. And I remember, I think it was Nelson George was like maybe the one, I was like, oh, music journalist, that's the, like the first time I'd ever saw that name under somebody that I didn't know what it was, and I was like, oh, that's what it is, you talk about the music. And so,
right.
I relate to that 100% in terms of writing. Is it like, for me, it has to be, I'm sort of I kind of lean more towards R&B music when I talk about it, but now I'm starting to just, like, anything to me, like, soul music is genreless, so that could mixed in with, like, it could be more than R&B, like, it could be, like, country, rock, jazz. It just depends on, you know, who it is or whatever, to where I can really hear the soul in it. And so when I listen to it, I try to, like, analyze it from what they're trying to say, like, in terms of the whole conceptual side of the album. Like, what are they trying to say? Like, what is this album about? And I like artists that have a, you know, the history of, like you say, like a Mary J. Blige or Faith Evans, like they have a history of making great albums. And so if it not necessarily have to reach the peak of classic, it just has to, what's the evolution? What, you know what I mean? I just want to get to the bottom
of,
okay, what are you actually saying? So what's your approach in terms of when you review an album, like, do you like, cause for me it's different cause I'm a musician, so I listen to it more so of the sonic sound. I go from like, three different elements. It's like the lyrics, production, and the vocal ability. Like, all those three things have to align for it to be a solid album for me. And if it doesn't, then if one of those three things are off, then it's not necessarily a bad album, but it's not completely, you know what I mean, solid to me if it doesn't have those three elements. So what's your, I guess, preparation for when you review an album or when you're listening to an album to review it?
One word. Time. I just let, you know, one thing that I appreciate about a lot of the critics of yesteryear was they gave the album time to marinate. You know, it's not like now where everything is so, everyone's in a rush to review an album because they want to get the hits on social media, or they want to get the press and everything. I really value giving an album time to marinate, you know, and giving the music and getting into the music and letting, you know, because I'm more of a musical guy anyway, so I just give the music time to marinate, you know, and then everything else falls. I've never been one to write about tap, you know, I've never been a gossip person anyway, so I, you know, you read reviews from a lot of today's critics, and I'm not saying this is for everybody, but you read it and it's like, okay, is that, you know, tabloid, related, or did you really listen to the album? You get what I'm saying? So I just really hone in on the music, and then it branches out into the lyrics. You know, what is this artist trying to convey, or what is this songwriter or songwriters trying to convey you know, within that particular album, you know, what is this single like compared to this particular album track? You know, does the single, you can tell when a single was released, and did it really help the album? Did it help propel the album, or did it, you know, does it really relate to what this album is about? For example, Erykah Badu, when she released New America, Part One, Fourth World War, we all know that the lead single for that album was actually Honey, but, you know, which is a nice summery, you know, funky, you know, track. But when you heard the album, and the album finally came out, this is not quite what Honey was. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, I just right. really hone into, you know, the music first, and then everything else follows, and then, you know, we can base it behind, you know, what that artist was going through at that time. You know, I like to write with context. I think context is another part that is, element that is missing in today's music journalism, in this field of journalism. I mean, there aren't that many writers that can really, base what they write on just the historical, meaning behind something, the historical significance behind something. I'm sorry. So I just try to write with context, and I try to focus on the music first, and, you know, everything else follows.
Yeah, that's, and then, you know, not to like harp on the ones that don't do it right. I think, like you said, context is so important in terms of
yes.
like the artist you talk about, like whether or not it's the year of the album, if you're talking about it specifically, but it's like, you gotta get all those details are important. And I think sometimes a lot of writers don't necessarily look at the error. And I think that's where experience comes in terms of like, when you really, cause people throw around historian titles and all that loosely, but do you really understand that era they were in? Do you really understand the artist that came out at the time and what made that album so significant, like Janet Jackson's Control album? Like, that's a significant
exactly.
album from hers. Most people think it's her debut album, but it's not. It's her
right,
song.
Right. And
you know,
and to piggyback but, off of that, Q, you know, and to piggyback on what you just said, you had to be around that period. You know, you had to be alive in that period to really understand the significance behind, you know, a lot of these albums that we revere highly today. You know, as a perfect example, Janet's Control, you know, I wouldn't expect someone who is of the, let's say, someone who basically just listens to rock music to understand, you know, what that album means for, and the black, when it comes to black music circles, you know what I'm saying? So
right.
I wouldn't give
right.
that piece to a person who, you know, is, you know, kind of has a certain view about Janet Jackson versus someone who, you know, was born on that music and grew up during that era and understood what the significance behind not just Janet Jackson as an artist and as a important figure, but the album itself. You know, what was that like? What was the era like? What was going on? What made what she did stand out among the others during that era? You get what I'm saying? So it really is important for a person for anyone who was born by that point and who digested that album and that era to really get more opportunities in writing about this stuff.
Exactly. You could go ahead, Whitney.
Oh, I just had a few because Q-Lynn covered quite a bit, but can you kind of talk to us about some of the experiences that you had in college that helped you while you were just learning I guess, how to, like, do the research on the music and just kind of gathering different ideas and learning, like, what you really wanted to do, I guess, like, with music journalism. I'm just interested to hear, like, what that looked like for you.
Yeah, well, my educational background in journalism, first and foremost, I was just dwelling. I was just trying to figure out, you know, what the world of journalism was about and, you know, media in general. You know, media is changing every single day. And I just threw myself into, a lot of courses. I wanted to do broadcast journalism, but I just wasn't comfortable with it. You know, I could do it. I've been told that I have the voice to pull it off, but I was like, no, you know, I'm more of a writer. I'm a writer at heart. So I just took some more, courses that dealt with, news reporting and news writing. And they're two different forms of news writing and reporting. And from there, I just looked at, news production and, you know, how to edit certain stories and how to do layout, you know, of a column, of a newspaper column or a magazine column or what have you. And from there, it was, digital photography and, how to, you know, basically what I'm saying is, you know, I was just looking at just everything. You have to learn everything in journalism and, you know, you have to be a sponge and, you know, take what you've acquired and apply them to, you know, the real world and when you get into your career, it'll be familiar to you. But as far as music journalism, I was just, even before I hit college, I was always writing about music. I did a couple of reviews on Amazon.com when I was younger, and people were like amazed that, you know, me at this young age, I'm writing about, you know, stuff on Amazon and, you know, user reviews that were, you know, just ordinary. But,
yeah,
you know, I just always had that, you know what I'm saying? So I just always had that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was always just a writer at heart and, you know, I just love music and, you know, thank God I just took to journalism in the way that I did.
I asked that because when I was just looking over, like, some of your information, I saw, like, radio briefly mentioned, and you do have a really good radio voice. Like, I can see you doing radio, so I was just curious, like, as to, you know, how you ended up going more towards one direction or another, but that all makes sense. And even Issa Rae kind of talks about, like, when she was first getting started, like, doing different things in film, how she for a little bit, like, put her hand in directing and then realized, that's not for me. She tried different things with production. It was like, that's not really my thing. She didn't really have the heart for it, but just starting out, like, she did exactly what you're describing. Like, she was kind of in all of it so that she could understand it. But then once she realized, like, okay, here's my focus area, I'm going to stick to this, and then I'll collaborate with other people I need to collaborate with to get to where I'm going. How important would you say that that's been, like, for your career, like, the collaboration piece, even, you know, knowing that you kind of had your hand in different pots there for a little bit, tried out some different things, realized, this part isn't for me, but still needing to, you know, work with others who do have a passion for those other areas that maybe you weren't so interested in?
Yeah, it's always, you know, media is, I always say networking is really central to journalism and media in general. It just, you know, being in the same room with people who, you know, are just as passionate as you are about whatever your beat or your subject is, you know, whether that's entertainment or sports or crime and law, it's just amazing to just be in and sharing the same ideas and really, you know, just learning about how people approach media in general. I remember I interned for WVON 1690 here in Chicago, which is a renowned black-owned radio station, Midway. Midway Broadcasting here in Chicago. And I mean, it was just interesting just see how everybody, no matter what topic of interest it was, whether that was politics, you know, they all came together and just made great content, great information and giving the public something to look forward to. You know, I just love telling great stories, and I think that everything and everyone has a story. So, you know, you just have to do your part and collaborate with people and, you know, just see how they approach media and news writing and production and just see where you fit in. You know, I find it fascinating.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. Now, switch over a little bit. You told us, like, who your, like, top four artists would be. Are there any, like, new artists that are out now or, like, newer music that you're listening to that kind of gets you excited or that you are like, I think I want to dig, you know, deeper into this particular artist and see, you know, kind of follow their career? Anybody like that stands out to you right now?
I don't listen to much mainstream, but I will say I like Jose James. Jose James. I like Janelle Monae. I think Janelle Monae is one of the forward-thinking, artists of today. Robert Glasper. He's done a lot of amazing work, not just in his own career, but for television and production and all of that. I can't really think of any other newer artists that, I listen to, but, those are the three that I would, kind of narrow down as far as today's artists.
Yeah, and I mean, that's fair. I ask people that sometimes just to see, like, if I'm missing artists, because I have a lot of younger, like, cousins and family members and stuff that I follow on social media, and I'll go through and listen to, stuff that they're putting out, and they've put me on to some artists that I wouldn't say, I'm like, ooh, this is about to be a legend right here necessarily, but I'm realizing, like, there are some artists out there that I'm like, yeah, when I'm just, driving around, like, just kind of casually listening, there are some artists out there that kind of pique my interest, here and there, but I find it, I'm like, I don't know if it's an age thing, but there's a disconnect with some of the music that's out right now. Like, I get where they're coming from, but just the, when you talk about telling, like, a story, and when I think about, like, the legends that we think of, their music, there were stories attached to them, and, like, you didn't want the song to end, and so you didn't care if it was, like, a 7-minute song, because, like, the song is fire.
Yes, and to piggyback on that, there was something called artist development. Everything just wasn't for the moment. Artists were developed to create, careers, that longevity. You get what I'm saying? Making music that creates a legacy. So, and I don't disparage, a lot of the current artists. I mean, there's some stuff that I've heard that does sound, pretty, it's an earworm. I hear a couple of songs that may catch my attention or something. But like you said, it's nothing that I would, like, go out and buy their album or, like, take to, say that I was a fan of them. You know what I'm saying? So, it is a big disconnect between the artists of today and artists that we revere or grew up on, coming up.
Right. And yeah, and I, when you were talking earlier, you mentioned, and it's something else I noticed, just, you know, just differences with the generations, but a lot of us did have, I'm calling it kind of a luxury now because it's so foreign to some, like, kids, but I remember seeing, you know, we had vinyls here and there, or if we didn't have it, I would see it at, like, a friend's house. I had the cassette tapes. Like, I came up with the physical items that I could touch, carry, see, open up, look at it, the liner notes you mentioned, like just the artwork, just everything. You could kind of see the process that somebody went through, or like the record label went through, like to really compile these things and put it together. Whereas now, you know, like we can pull up Spotify, Pandora, Tidal, any of those. You can still see the credits.
The
you can still, you know, exactly.
It's
and I
same.
Do that because I grew up seeing the credits. So I always go and click and be like, oh, who, you know, who's on this and all of that. But there is something about like being able to physically touch, see, you know, get connected with the actual product that I feel connected a lot of us to the art itself.
Yeah, and it also tells you something about the person. You know, when you go into a person's home and you see their collection, you know, it tells you something about that person's taste, you know, to actually see their physical collection displayed in their home. You know, I remember going to someone's home and they just said, well, my music collection is on a hard drive. And I said, well, you don't own at least a stack of CDs or you know, albums, you know what I'm saying? Or it would be no different you know, you went to a person who read books and they tell you that their books was on a Kindle or an iPad.
Right.
You know, it's just not the same.
Right.
So you have to have that connection. It just says something about a person, you know, when you go and view their collection and you see just how it's displayed and you know, you get a sense of what their taste is like. And you're like, you know, oh, so you're into Miles Davis, or you're into Wes Montgomery, or you're into Van Halen, or what have you. So it's just, you know, it's cool to really get to the tangible part of a person's collection.
Absolutely. Wow. Okay, now my final question, since we're talking about collection. So if we walked into your home, your work, or something like that, what type of musical collection would we see, like, that represents you?
Ooh, you would see an assortment of vinyls and, you know, stacks and stacks of CDs. And, you know, I got stuff that, I try to keep things organized. I do organize my albums, but, you know, as far as CDs, I mean, just stuff that's stacked and, you know, I'm working, so, you know, I might pull out an album. Yes, I do still play CDs. Nothing wrong with that at all. But you know, you would just see stacks and stacks of CDs and, you know, I have my vinyl, you know, arranged in a certain way and, you know, I try to keep them, collected and, you know, they're not in alphabetical order, but, you know, I try to commit it to memory and, you know, just music. It's like a shrine almost.
Nice. I like it. Well, that was my final one. I was just curious. I like to be nosy about what's up in people's houses. So,
you know what? You made two, before we go to break, cause we're fixing to go break in like a millisecond. But before we go to break, I just have two things to say. One, whenever she asked you that question about, what kind of new music? I just want to say you gave the most eloquent answer of not calling it trash. I need to implement your vocabulary more because I just call it trash. That's it. That's I need to be more tactful. Yeah, right.
Nowadays you got to be politically correct. So.
Right. I just want to point out how eloquent that answer was, because, you know, sometimes I just, you know, say it how it is, but I need to implement what you're saying more. And the second part, when you were talking about going into what you had in your household before she answered you that question in terms of your collection, I just want, you said you had an array of different music. I just want to say mine as well, but it's more leaning towards, you know, you might see some Herbie Hancock vinyls, you know, Sonny Rollins, a lot of jazz records, mm-hmm. Prince records, Rick James, but then also, you know, I got my own stack of, like, it's going to be like Uncle Luke, you know, 3-6 Mafia, you know, Cash Money taking over for 99 2000, you know, just a different, you know, you know, you might see, you know, covers, you know, Uncle Luke cover with butt-naked women on it, but yeah, that's just what it is, you know, just like Millie Jackson record, I got, you know, her vinyl of her sitting on the toilet, you know, with her legs, you know, with fishnets on, okay, it's just different kinds, you know?
Yeah.
All kinds. I got Dolemite records as well. I got Ray Moore album covers and, you know, got half naked people on it. You know, it's just, you know, it's all beautiful black art. Right. So why not? Okay, Black History Month. You gotta, you know, you gotta represent for all black.
Sorry.
Blackness is a diaspora. It's not just one kind of black. So I'm just trying to. Yeah. Right, exactly. It's Black History Month. We gotta represent for all black diasporas.
Right.
But we're going to go to break.
Yeah, right.
We're going to break real quick.
We get it. Okay. So much for, so much
Will,
for the millisecond.
I'm just trying to explain.
So much for the millisecond.
Will, listen, that was it.
Yeah, that was a millisecond, all right.
Will.
Oh yeah. Hey, welcome back. Hey, to the Soul 70 Show with Q Lynn Green Whitney and a very special guest. And I want to remind the audience, if Q Lynn say a millisecond, it's like that country preacher said, we're almost over. The country preacher, you've already been there for 3 hours. I'm almost done. Okay, all right. Back to you, Q.
Listen, I made two quick points.
Yeah, real quick. Yeah, 3.5 Listen, minutes. Yeah, well, that was quick, girl. All right, you're getting better.
I said it was going to be quick. It was two quick points.
Yeah, real
quick. I don't know what you're talking about, man. Whatever, man. Yeah. Whatever, man.
Love you too, Q.
Anyway, we're going to... Well, you always trying to shut up. We got company on. Anyway.
I know.
Look.
Soul Savages, baby.
It's
2021.
Right. We got that was the 35th album anniversary of Janet Jackson's concert. Uh-oh.
Woman, hold it. You getting pulled over. Are you getting pulled over?
That was not coming from me. I don't know if that was...
I don't know if it was me.
Listen. But celebrated the 35th album anniversary of Janet Jackson's Control album.
Okay, yeah,
Control. When I think of you. Yeah, I need you to control yourself while we got guests on. I need you to do that. I need you to control yourself. Listen, album anniversary. Listen, I can't control him. I'm about to. Will, I need you to relax, man. Relax.
Okay.
Man.
All right. Okay.
Listen, we gotta relax. But anyway, listen, he made me lose my train of thought. Well, the album anniversary of Janet Jackson's Control album. It's a really great album. People say it's her best. I don't like categorizing it, you know, it's just a really great album. I think it was a pivotal time and pivotal moment of when she released it, and I think it's evident by how, like, largely, you know, it's received by the masses as her best album. But, yeah, the whole album in its entirety, I mean, majority of the songs were hits, were singles, and they were just amazing. You know, like I said, Jimmy Jam, Terry Lewis, they were doing their thing, you know. This really just catapulted everything they were doing in the 80s and just made them like the go-to. They were already go-to producers when they did like the SOS Band and Alexander O'Neill Records and Sherelle, but this one just took it to a whole new level. But yeah, I think it's amazing that it's been 35 years, and I know I'm sure it's present and everybody else's, you know, that was around during that time that were of age when it came out. Like, it's like Janet Jackson's pivotal. But what you think about the Control album? I know we talked about it a little bit earlier in the show, but what you think about it, Brandon?
Yeah, most definitely. Control is to Janet as Off the Wall is to her older brother, Michael Jackson. I mean, you can't even overstate its significance. I think that without Control, I don't even think Janet Jackson, we would be, you know, sitting here talking about her, in the way that we are tonight or anyone else, for that matter. But it's her third album, and most people, it's so great that most people think it's her debut album, but it's really her third album. I mean, for me, it's my favorite Janet Jackson album. You have Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis at their peak, but also Monty Moore. You have Jelly Bee Johnson, you know, her moving to the Minneapolis sound and, you know, coming into her own. I think the best aspect of Control isn't so much isn't just the music itself and the fantastic production and, you know.
Yeah. For sure. It's just the got up tempos, mid tempos, and the ballads. It's just a well rounded album, and I think all those records, like I said, it just speaks to Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis's genius. Also, Jovian John is one of my favorites of all time. So, you know, that whole Prince camp, it's like, you know, I just have a whole admiration for that whole conglomerate of just talented musicians and producers and songwriters. But, yeah, that album is just incredible. What's your top three from Control album? Whoever wants to go, what's your top three?
Okay, what happened?
Did I lose somebody?
Did we lose?
I was trying to figure out.
Did we lose?
I don't know. We could, you know.
I think we did.
We could tell jokes.
I think he had a little technical difficulty. He'll call back in. But what's your top three, Whitney? From the Control album, we got "Let's Wait a While," "When I Think of You," "Pleasure Principle." Those were the hits from that album.
"Let's Wait a While." I remember that one. Like, hearing that one all the time. Like that's probably my fave. "What Have You Done for Me Lately?" I liked dancing to that as a kid. That was just fun. Like that when I think about Janet Jackson. That was like the thing, you know, because as a kid, like I ain't really caring about a bunch of some of the other stuff, but you know, moving around, feeling upbeat, like Janet made you want to move. And then, you know, later we got Sultry Janet, but at that time, like that was upbeat, fun, I want to party, have no idea what you're talking about, but you know.
Wait, did you call her Florentry Janet? Is that what you said?
No, I said Sultry. What?
Oh,
I thought
later you said
we got
Florentry.
More of Sultry. No.
Oh, okay.
I do like Florentry.
I thought you were making a joke,
but
cause
no.
She did a record. I thought she was talking about the record she did with Q-Tip. That, don't know what you got to the skunk. That song with Q-Tip.
Oh,
I thought she was in that. You remember that video when she had those plaits and the nose ring? That's what I thought you were talking about.
Yeah.
I thought you were calling that the floor tree.
Sorry,
that's
guys.
What I thought you were.
Yeah.
No, you're good, man.
Sorry, guys.
We just keep it short.
Sorry,
no,
guys.
You're fine. No, you're good,
my
man.
My phone cut off.
Hey, look, it happens, man. It's live radio. It happens sometimes.
I thought I was going to have to fill in, you know, for you, bro. But didn't we?
No, that's not.
Don't worry about it. It's live radio. So, but that whole album was great though. Control, Nasty, Pleasure Principle, right? Let's Wait a While. Hey, back to you, Q.
Yeah, man. Let's Wait a While. That's the ballad right there. Everybody's song. I love how she went from that to like, "Let's Wait a While" to nasty boy. It went like a whole transition after that. I just loved it. It was the evolution of who she was. And then it was like, Anytime, Any Place. It went from "Let's Wait a While" to "Anytime, Any Place." It was like the evolution came like real fast for Janet. But I love it though. But, I was asking Whitney, what was her, the question was, what's your top three from the Control album? I said, you know, I was just naming off like "Let's Wait a While" and all those joints from there, but what's your top three?
Well, my top three, well, my number one favorite would have to be, "Pleasure Principle." Just the production of it, just everything. It's probably the densest song on the whole Control album, but it's still fun. It's still very catchy. My second favorite would have to be "Funny How Time Flies When You're Having Fun," the final track on the album, the slow jam. Jam that started, you know, her signature slow jams. And my third favorite would have to be, that's the hard one. I want to say "Nasty," but then again, I want to say, you know, "When I Think of You," That's a hard one. But I think I'm gonna go with Nasty. It features the playful strings with the industrial synthesizers and drums and that, you know, that funky, you know, arrangement. I mean, and then of her, you know, her, of course, her trademark, you know, my name ain't a baby is Jackson, is Miss Jackson if you're nasty and all of that.
Right.
I mean, it's just amazing. And the video is great too. I love it.
Yeah. Nasty, that's what I'm talking about too. I don't want to get to that. She'd be like, oh, here comes my favorite part. I'm like, that's my favorite part too when it get to that, when it get to that van breakdown. It's just that way that thing is knocking. It's like, oh, this is amazing.
And then the jazzy chord progressions. I mean, it's that,
yes,
you know.
Absolutely.
I mean, throughout this whole album, well, in moments of this album, you know, you hear it in, you know, and What Have You Done For Me Lately, you know, near the end,
right,
it breaks out into that breakdown, that instrumental breakdown that's just so beautiful and you know, the way it's just sequenced and everything, and then, and you know, and Nasty, the breakdown. I mean, just the movements, the musical movements all throughout these songs are just phenomenal. I love Jam and Lewis. I love what they brought to the game.
Yeah. Those synths, man. That was the first time I had somebody play like some, like you said, it was jazzy and it was also like little gospel chords in there too. It's just the way the chord is, the progression is like, oh man, this is amazing. But yeah, great album. What I was going to do real quick, we do this thing on a show called Raggedy and Savvy News. I was going to do that just for a few moments before we go to break again. And then we can talk about, these, belated birthday appreciations, with, the late Rick James and Anita Baker and Charlie Wilson. We're going to get into that. But first we're going to talk about Raggedy News. And just, it's not a lot. You know, Whitney was hitting me to what was going on, because I haven't been paying attention. But I did see this, last night because I was on Twitter. And Twitter really informs me of all the stuff that's going on, but it's been Raggedy News. Again, this is his face, you know, he can do, you know, this is his claim, he can do, this young guy can do whatever he wants to, but this young rapper named Lil Uzi Vert, you know, has implemented, or mostly implanted, a $24 million diamond in the middle of his forehead. It looked kind of crooked to me, but yeah, it's like pierced or something, like implanted, like, it was like it was pierced in his head or something. And yeah, that was interesting. I was like, I didn't know if I could call it raggedy, but I would have to put it, it would have to be categorized as Raggedy News because, you know, what is that, sir? What's the point of that? Like, when you're 87 and you have grandkids and they'd be like, Grandpa, what's that in the middle of your, like, they're gonna think you like an extra character from X-Files or something. Like, they gonna know what you look like when you get of a certain age. It's like, what's the purpose of that? I honestly, like I said, it's his face, but I'm just interested in what y'all think of this guy implanting a whole $24 million carat diamond in the middle of his head where everybody in public knowledge can see it. What do y'all think of that?
I caught wind of it on Twitter last night. And I was like, oh, this is the guy. Oh, okay. So he's put that on his forehead. It just, I don't get it. And then I read something today where he said, you know, in order for me to remove it, I have to remove it. You know, if I ever wanted to remove it, I would have to remove it in a certain way or I would die. Like whatever procedure that they would have to do to remove whatever that is on his forehead. You know, he would probably pass away. And it's just ridiculous. I just.
Wow.
We are really living in our last days.
Right. Why would you, listen, Whitney, you go ahead before I put my last statement on that. Go ahead.
when I saw it, first off, I didn't see it. Like somebody sent it to me. And so then I went and like tracked all of it back. To see, like, first off, why? And then the price, $24 million, is a 10 carat, and this is a pink diamond. So it's rare. Like, you can't just get a pink diamond anywhere. He had been paying towards it. Like, he had been paying millions, like, a month. Like, this is a thing that he sat and, like, planned to do. And I'm just trying to understand, like, from I don't even know what perspective at this point. Like, just why? Like, what's the, like, you know, like, when I was younger and I would think of, like, outlandish things to do, it was more like, ooh, could I have like a staircase that has an aquarium attached to it? Like, that to me was outlandish. But like, I never in my mind thought, and I feel like I could still pull that off somehow. But anyway, a diamond in the forehead, and then hearing just now Brandon talking about like the procedure he would need to have it removed, and it, you know, costing him his life potentially. I can't really wrap my mind around like what, like, why you would do it. I don't understand it. But, you know, again, it's his face and his money. And, I mean, I guess it's nice that he could afford to do that. But I don't understand it at all. I just thought it was really, it was just shocking when I saw it. Like, it makes my stomach hurt when I see, I've looked at it. And it makes me feel queasy. Like,
weird.
Why would you do that? It is. Yeah. Like, I don't get it.
Yeah, this new era of artists are very strange, and, you know, I remember back in the day, it was just like, the rappers would just buy chains and gold teeth. That was like the standard for it.
Right.
Now it's like, oh, let's see how weird, it's like, they have like a weird spectrum, and it's like, oh, how weird can we make it? And uncomfortable for everybody that's fans of you. But apparently, you know, some of the fans don't really, I guess they, I don't know, I don't know what it's, the Uzi Vert, what do they call them, Little Guns or something, I don't know what the fans are called.
I have no idea.
You know, hopefully they're not encouraged by this foolishness, you know, but, you know, for me, just to wrap this part up, cause if you put a whole gun to, like, a Uzi in the front of my head to make me name a Uzi verse, so I couldn't tell you. Not one tune of his, but I would say, I have no clue. I just see him as a meme on Instagram and Twitter. That's literally what I know him from. And apparently he's dating a city girl. I don't understand why you would get that. You date a city girl that say, don't give a fuck about a nigga. Like, somebody would probably, she would probably thump you in your head in the middle of an argument. I don't know why would date somebody that's known for, you know, she said, what's that, bad bitch, don't give a fuck about a nigga. What's that, I don't know what that lyric is, but yeah, those kind of lyrics, you date somebody like that. So hopefully that works out and, you know, yeah, somebody, to me, it's just an open invitation for somebody to try to, like, take that out of your head. And if it's, like, you have to have procedure done to it, I feel like, out of all this, like, it logically doesn't make sense, because I'm thinking, well, if it's pierced and so, it can fall out, like, you know, randomly, somehow. Either you sleep wrong, or somebody will try, like, if we open back up to the public and you start going, like, which he probably, he seems like COVID don't scare him, so I'm assuming he's already out here in, like, Atlanta, where these jam-packed, COVID-ridden clubs and venues that are opening, like Atlanta. Yeah, I'm sure he's performing there, and somebody will try to attempt to take that. That's just my thinking, because it does logically doesn't make sense to do that.
No.
But, yeah.
Mm-mm.
Comments, because this so young behavior, because it's like, for me, it's like, okay, logistically, if you have to get taken out a certain way, why would you even, like, do something that's that, like, severe to where death is involved? Like, anything that death, like, you know, when I was in my 20s, like, having a good time was there. But the limit, death is a limit for me. Like, it's like near-death experience. I mean, I guess it's still exciting in the early 20s, but, you know, I digress. You know, have fun with that little Uzi Vert, you know, the pink diamond implant. Have fun with that, okay? Hopefully, you know, nothing disparaging happens to where, you know, you have to get that surgically removed because of other reasons, because somebody wants to Thanos style, take that out your head. I don't know. Hopefully that works out for him. I don't know. but the only other Raggedy News topic was something. I thought it was funny. And like I said, Raggedy is in the Raggedy category, because it's like, man, why would you do this? If you didn't know, I just randomly threw this one in here because I just saw it earlier today. This woman on the internet has decided to share with us that in one of her hair care routines, she somehow hairsprayed Gorilla Glue in her head.
Yes.
As replacement for hairspray. And I just want to say, ma'am, why? Again, why?
Why?
And then she had the nerve to tell us, the audience, because we're first graders and didn't know not to put Gorilla Glue in our hair. She explains to the audience, to us, that, listen, don't ever do, like, ma'am, that's just you, ma'am. That's literally just
right.
You. Nobody that's at this big age is doing that. That's not even,
no.
I don't even know why you had to, you know, give us a PSA on that, ma'am. We're good. I've never, like, did a hair tutorial with natural hair. It was like, hey, you know what? I need this Gorilla Glue. It's going to hold the edges down. It's going to lay it down. It's going to lay it down all the way. Let me just get this Gorilla Glue.
Her edges were really laid, though. They was really laid.
Yeah.
And not a hair was
they
out
did.
Of place.
Exactly.
Wow. Her hair ain't going nowhere. Okay.
She has contact with Jermaine Jackson's hairstylist. That's what it looks like. Like Jermaine Jackson's
hairstylist.
Just
shampoo it.
Oh, Lord.
Why shampoo
right.
it to make it look shinier? It just,
Gorilla,
she has the hair texture. She has the hair texture of a black Barbie Ken doll. That's what it looked like.
Oh, my gosh, it did.
It's never moving. It's not moving.
It's never moving.
Like, she was brushing her hand through her. It's real. It's on the internet. I thought it was interesting. I was like, yeah. But just on to Savvy News, that's just my wrap-up of that topic. Ma'am, why? That's all I have for it. That's very... And I didn't even know they had it in a spray can. That was news to me. Okay.
What?
I'm there. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't even know it came in a spray can. I was like, oh. What's Gorilla Glue is strong as hell.
Hell yeah.
It's strong, man.
Yes, it is.
I think they seal it with, I think all my Amazon boxes are filled with Gorilla Glue.
Hey, was this a wig?
Yeah.
Okay. I missed some of it. Was it a wig?
No, it's
no.
Her real hair. It's just
like
she said,
Will,
yes.
you gotta look it up, man. If like I kept looking at the video trying to figure out, okay, is she just doing this and it's not really like maybe, you know, it was a joke, but then the more I looked at it, I'm like, no, I think she really did this. Like why
yeah.
would you again? Why? I don't know what's going on.
Oh God.
Yeah, it looked like she was vying for attention at first, and then she was really serious, and then she was crying in the second video when she tried to shampoo it and show the people that it's really. I mean, and then she kind of broke down and cried almost, but it was, you know,
it really looked bad.
It was the color contact for me that was like, I didn't know that was still a thing.
The PSA should happen,
why you got these color contacts? If somebody on Twitter said, if you took some color contacts out, you would have saw that you were using Gorilla Glue. I thought that was funny.
No. Oh, God.
that was funny. Yeah.
I need to see that.
I was like, yeah, that's a valid point. You take some color contacts out, you probably could have seen it was Gorilla Glue. Q-Man. Yeah.
Send it to me. I need, that's material.
I'm gonna try to find a way to share it. But moving on to better news, savvy news.
Was it a wee?
Savvy news. We go to savvy news real quick before we go to break. It will kiss. It will kiss. Stop laughing. So we go to the next
weave. Yeah. Yeah. Was it a weave? Well, there was some weave stuff going on. I need to know. Okay. All right. Anyway.
It's her, I guess she had a ponytail in. I don't know what she did with that. I don't know. It was, I have no idea. Yeah. Hopefully that works out for her.
It's not working.
I'm gonna save her whole head off.
Problem.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sorry.
I'm just saying, just go to the hospital, girl. Go to the hospital.
So
for real.
Right. I told you, man. The way she was brushing her head and it didn't do nothing. It didn't move at all. I was like,
it ain't gonna move.
Like I said. Yeah.
What'd you think?
It's like she got the black Ken doll hair. Yeah. Like that's what's going on there. Like it's not moving. I think that's she got the Jermaine Jackson. Like I said, the Jermaine Jackson style. I don't know if that's gonna get out of there. You know, it's been in there. But anyway, Savvy news, real quick.
Okay.
Savvy, Weeknd, it said he put up his own money for this Super Bowl performance. Super Bowl airs on, I think, CBS on this coming up Sunday. I think it's Tampa Bay versus Kansas City, and they have a lot of different performances. I think Jasmine Sullivan is doing the national anthem. I read and. The Weeknd, but the main story is Weeknd. He put up his $7 million for his Super Bowl performance. And my thing is this: I'm hearing that it's like, you know, I think most of them are virtual performances. Maybe I think some of them are pre-taped, and some of them may be live with the national anthem. But it's like, why? I don't understand why it's so much money poured into. I mean, I guess it's a good thing, but I mean. I just thought that was an abnormal thing that he paid his own money for the performance. It must be a virtual live performance, but what y'all think of that?
No, they started that years ago. They started that years ago.
Where they pay it?
Yep, that the performance had to pay to be there. Depend on how big you were. Oh, yes.
I didn't know that was a thing. Yeah.
I didn't either, but...
Oh yes.
From what I read, like the Weeknd is I don't know what he has envisioned for his performance, but whatever it is, that's why he put up his own money. So I'm interested to see what it looks like so I can see where the $7 million went, cuz I'm like, I really hope that it comes out how he wanted to, cuz I believe his is one of the virtual. No, take that back. His will be performed in front of like a few attending people, so maybe that's why he did it, because he's gonna have a small crowd. But either way, maybe that is a normal thing that people do, but I wasn't aware of that. It just seemed like a lot to me. But I mean, $1 million, $500 right now is a lot to me. I saw $7 million. I was like, that's kind of hefty.
I would invite all of you to fact check me, but this is not new. It has nothing to do with what's going on now. For years going back, several years, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 years to where they started charging the performers to pay. Now, I don't know whether Beyonce had to do it, and I think it depends on the act, but that's where they start charging these acts to pay to be on the Super Bowl, because it's their pay way of advertising themselves. Fact check me, if you will.
Right. I knew that they didn't pay people to perform, but I thought that that they took care of the cost, associated with it.
These are super pimps, okay?
Oh, yeah, that's the whole thing.
I guess right. So, because I'm not doing it. But, you know, that's their money. I'm glad he got $7 million that he can put up to do his stuff the way he wants to. But, like I said, I'm interested to see what it looks like, because that's a nice price tag for a short amount of time.
Right. And the next story. Oh, go ahead, Brandon.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's $7 million.
Mhm. Yeah, he put up $7 million of his money. Yeah.
Listen, Saturday and Sunday, it better be good for all that money. Okay? You don't need Nate Saturday and Sunday put on the performance of his wife. You know, y'all always like to compare to Michael Jackson. You better give something like that. Okay.
Well, look at what they charge for 30-second. Look at what they charge for 30 and 60-second commercials. $2 and $3 million per.
Oh, yeah. That's always the main attraction, though. I think they're kind of different, though. Because I think people more so anticipate the commercials more than the performances. I don't think it hasn't been like that big of an artist to where they were like, oh, my God, I can't wait to watch the Super Bowl performance until, like, Beyonce. Like, that was probably the only attraction to where people was, like, anticipating it, and it actually did numbers, and then the numbers went back down after it was over with. So I think she's probably the only one in recent history that's made an impact. But, yeah, the Super Bowl commercials are always classic because they always have, like, surprise celebrities, people you probably haven't seen in a while, and they collaborate with other singers or actors, and it's always a fun little quirky commercial. Now, I did hear about, speaking of Super Bowl commercials, somebody let it out. I don't know who it was, but the Where the Money Resides guy, he's supposed to, I hate that. I remember, I think his name is Darrell, but he has, I think, a Honda commercial. I think he's partnered with Honda, and he's supposed to be having his debut commercial for the Super Bowl coming out on Sunday. For the Super Bowl, so big ups to him. That's savvy. You know, he's just really out. He took that whole phrase and trademarked it. I thought that was like a good thing because people have been saying it everywhere. Then I saw the Mayo version of that, and I was like, sir, like, I need you to clap on beat. Like, if you go steal it, at least do it right, you know. But again, he was very smart to, you know, trademark that because the Mayos got a hold of it trying to, you know, sell their little Subarus and stuff. It's like, sir, I want no Subaru.
What happened?
Did she
lose her voice? I don't know.
I really don't know.
Okay, but anyway. Hey, Brandon. Hey, bro, I just want you to know, man, I had your back when we got disconnected before, right? Don't worry about it, bro. All right? I had you.
Okay, thank you.
Now, you pronounce your last name Owsley. Is that?
Owsley, yes.
Owsley, okay. Why don't we go to a music break? We'll be right back, and perhaps Q-Lin might decide to join us. I don't know. Okay, in the meantime.
You had to bring that up. We'll go to break. We're going to play Give a Birthday Appreciation to Charlie Wilson. We'll be right back, y'all. Y'all get into these Charlie Wilson.
Well, you gave me Zap and Roger.
Yeah.
Okay.
Featuring Charlie Wilson on vocals. Y'all get into Charlie Wilson vocals. We'll be back, y'all.
Let's do it. Sure. In love. Yeah. Oh, man. And before that, Zapp and Roger, slow and easy. Hey, welcome back to the Soul 70 Show with Q Lynn, and Whitney, and special guest, Brandon Ousley.
Yeah, man. That's the one right there.
Listen,
once again, happy belated birthday to legendary singer-songwriter Charlie Wilson. Listen, February is just not only Black History Month, but it's just some really great legendary black music acts that were born in this month. And like I said, Charlie Wilson, Anita Baker, and Rick James, all, you know, well, Anita's in January, the end of January, but it's on the cusp, whatever. But also, it's going to be Bobby Brown's birthday tomorrow, and then the next day after that, the late Bob Marley. But again, you know, only 2 hour show. I couldn't play. If I could play all that in there, I would. But yeah, just, Charlie Wilson's, like I said earlier in the show, his influence with just R&B itself and just the evolution of it, and from my home state, Oklahoma. You know, Oklahoma native is just what makes me a top fan as well. But Charlie Wilson, I remember listening to his Questlove Supreme interview up on that podcast, Questlove Supreme. He interviewed with them. He's talking about his in terms of being mentored by Roger Troutman and just his influence. And those records, I feel like those records was like, for me, that's where I got introduced to it. I'm like, what is this? And then it's like following that, you know, even though he was already out, but just that time period where he was working with Roger Troutman and, you know, can't forget about Shirley Murdock and as well her vocals. But I feel like those two always made those records stand out. That's why I played that, because it's one of my favorite Zapp records. And then I'm In Love, that was from the Gant Band One album. I think it came out in 1979. It's just a fantastic, again, we played, actually, on Mary's birthday, we played her rendition of I'm In Love, and it's fantastic as well. But, yeah, that song right there is just, he's in the pocket. He's showing, for me, I'm In Love, he's, like, showing the range of what he could do with his voice. And he's always had such a great upper register with his tone, and I just always loved it. But, yeah, he's a student of Stevie Wonder as well. So, but, yeah. Charlie Wilson, it's hard for me to pick my favorite Charlie Wilson songs, but just the whole Gap Band catalog, you can count me in for that. And then his solo records, they were great too. I remember all my uncles, like, that was part of the road trip music, was listening to Charlie Wilson's when he started making solo records. And it's, I think it came out in 2001. I think it was Bridging the Gap. Like that album, his first, that solo album right there, that's the one I remember most. Like, we used to wear that album out. But y'all have any particular favorite Charlie Wilson songs?
Go ahead, Whitney.
No, you good. Go ahead.
Okay. I love Charlie Wilson's voice. I'm more partial to his stuff with his with the Gap Band, the Wilson Brothers.
Right.
My favorite Gap Band song is actually a ballad, Nothing Comes to Sleepers.
Woo!
I love that song. That dreamy, sentimental, I just love it. It's, it kind of reminds me, that's the one that really, gives off a strong Stevie Wonder influence in his voice. And, you know, it's just so dreamy. It's so eloquent. It's just everything. And then, of course, you know, yearning for your love, and the song, that just got done playing, I'm In Love. I just love the ballads that he sings. But I like his, the funk ones too, Burn Rubber on Me, of course, and Humpin', and, a lot of their old catalog. But phenomenal voice. Bridging off of what Q was saying about, the Stevie Wonder influence, he also, was mentored by the late, great DJ Rogers, who passed away last year. So, he played keyboards on a lot of his stuff, and I think he picked up a lot of his vocal, some of his vocal traits from him as well. So, but all together, it's all for the love of music, and, I'm just glad that he's still with us at this present time.